TFM.
Welcome back, everyone, to Saddle Up, our dedicated Star Trek Strange New Worlds podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, it's great to be able to saddle up again. And if you want, I can take your saddle for you if needed.
All right, Chris. It's so good to be back and in the saddle. But I'm sorry, Chris. Unfortunately, a man likes to hold his own gear and take care of his own gear. So I appreciate the offer. But no thank you.
All right. Well, don't worry. I think maybe La'an needs some help with her saddle.
Yeehaw, cowboy.
All right, everyone. It's great to be back on Saddle Up. It's been so long. This is one of those shows where we only do it when a new season is airing and we go week by week. Matthew, as you know, I had to jump through, let's keep the horse metaphor going here. I had to jump over a lot of obstacles to be able to watch this episode so that we can talk about it today. Apparently, we're not getting season 4 in Japan, or at least not for some time. Paramount decided in March. I didn't know it until a few days ago, and I was expecting season 4 to premiere. Apparently, Paramount, back at the end of March, pulled out of the Japanese market, and so some deals were made with JCOM and WowWow, apparently to keep existing content available, but haven't seen anything new come through. So anyway, I found a way to get access to Paramount Plus in the US, and I was just able to watch this yesterday. So here we are. We're going to be talking about it. And this is the premiere of season 4. It's Valis Marineris. And here is a quick rundown of the story. After some equestrian fun time, Pike and the crew of the Enterprise are sent to observe a giant space squall. Once there, they pick up a distress signal and attempt to respond. But the squall overwhelms the ship, and the Enterprise is thrown to an unknown system with three Class M planets. It turns out that their new location isn't so unknown after all. It's the Sol system. But there's a catch. They've traveled 65 million years into the past. The landing party has ventured down to a prehistoric Earth in search of iridium to restart the warp drive, and the Enterprise has been captured by a powerful ship from Mars. There's also an extra planet on the way out to Jupiter, one that's at war with Mars. To get home, the crew must put their skills to the test against hostile aliens, dinosaurs, engine warning lights, and a particularly spunky Vulcan cadet. So, Matthew, it's a new season. We're finally here. What are your first impressions?
Well, Chris, I think what we actually learned in this episode is that there can only be a sole survivor in the Sol system. I mean, that's the thing we learn. Like you said, we're starting off the season. And, you know, both you and I had a real kind of almost love-hate relationship with season 3. It was one of those where at one moment we get an episode we really liked, and then at the next moment it just felt like the episode fell flat or just didn't work, or they had tried too hard or something. And I mean, I'm going to spoil it right away because I want to enjoy talking about this episode, but this is an incredible start to season 4. This is exactly what I want from this show. This is, in fact, I think exactly the, you know, we've been talking about on our rewatch of Star Trek Voyager, right? That the show, when it began, it kind of started with a promise of what the show would be and what they'd be discussing, what they'd be exploring. And Strange New Worlds did the same thing, right? I remember all the way back in season 1, and it kind of made this promise about being back to exploring, being back to kind of being more classic Star Trek, you know, being more contained in some ways. while at the same time being able to have characters grow and all that. But this just felt like everything that I had wanted from, say, season three that we just didn't get. And I loved watching this episode. In fact, I'm so glad that I got a chance to rewatch it because it confirmed to me that it's actually just a great episode of the series. Mm-hmm. And it's a good episode of Star Trek in general.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a key. Yeah. I think our reaction to season three is the most common fan reaction to season three. There were some great episodes that fans loved, and there were other episodes where fans are like, what are you guys doing? And so we're all wondering, what is it going to be like heading into season four? What are they going to do? And also knowing that these seasons were shot kind of back to back, they're working on the scripts. There wasn't like a bit, even though it's been a while since, well, it hasn't been in streaming terms, it hasn't been so long, right? But even though it's been a while since we had new episodes, it's not like they had this lengthy period of time where they could think about fan reaction and rework what they were doing. So we're wondering, well, what are they going to do? And like you said, I think they started off the season by giving us a great Star Trek episode. They're, you know, it's got this great mix of an intriguing story. It has its funny moments. It has its very depressing and troubling moments. We actually have to watch an entire planet be destroyed. You know, Pike has to make that decision. And they also are able to keep developing the characters in this series that's not serialized in the way something like Discovery was serialized, but it's also not completely standalone. But watching it, yeah, I was feeling like, you know, there was this little like clamor. You're hearing things around online like, yeah, season four, some of the writer's worst tendencies or the wrong lessons that they learned from fan reactions are coming through again. And I had heard a little bit about that. And so coming into this, I was wondering, am I going to see that? And I wasn't seeing any of it. I was just seeing like really good Star Trek. So I think that part of that probably comes from what so many people are doing where I guess, you know, they've gotten screeners of the first six episodes and they want everybody to know they have screeners of the first six episodes. So instead of just talking about the premiere, they've got to roll everything up into one and then kind of do an early review of the season based on more than half of the season, which I really wish people wouldn't do it that way. That's not my style.
And I think,
but
you know, one of the things about the show being dropped an episode at a time, right, is I appreciate that in many ways because for us, it allows us to be able to take each episode as it is without, you know, having the coloring of a previous episode or, you know, the whole season or whatever. And so I think that's the beauty of this is that I get to just watch this episode and I've read all those things too and I've seen all those things. And, you know, look, we know the season has puppets coming at some point.
We've known that for a long time.
Right. And yet I think the best part about this episode is, again, it just allows itself and the writers just worked, it seemed like, to craft a classic Star Trek episode where, you know, we've got moral conundrums and we've got character moments and we've got crazy things happening that you would never expect. You know, I mean, when they show you the trailer for this season and they're dinosaurs and you're like, what in the world? How did Jurassic Park happen on this show? You know, I think all of that. But again, just kind of coming into the season and coming off, you know, a season three where it was, you know, at most a mixed bag. This was just such a breath of refreshing, you know, 65 million year air, right?
Like, wow, yeah. It has a bit of a stench, I have to say.
You would think, know, but actually very clean, you know. A little bit of sulfur in the air because of the volcano, but and the dino dung. That'll do it.
Dino dung,
but,
yeah.
Yeah. But, you know.
Refreshing dino dung, yeah.
Yeah. So it just really, and the other thing about this too was You know, sometimes Strange New Worlds can do a thing where the humor can kind of overtake the episode and take you out of some key moments. And I felt like for the most part, again, this was a place where as the season begins, they found almost completely, not always, but almost completely the right mixture of the Strange New Worlds type of humor with the seriousness, and all of that was just working together. And so, you know, this is not final thoughts. This is just coming into the season. But man, what a banger of an episode, right? Like, just what a great way to kick off season four, especially for us fans, knowing that there's only one more season left and it's a shorter season at that. And so it leaves you just really hopeful for the rest of the season, hoping that this is the type of episode we get more often than not.
Right. Yeah. We know we're not going to get it every time because, again, there are puppets on the way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm certainly hoping that this is more standard for the season. Watching it, not even to the end of it, just, you know, halfway through or so, I was just thinking, like, this feels like season one, but with much more developed characters. Like, the style of the story felt like those season one stories that we loved so much, where we felt like it was a modern TOS. Even in season one, you know, we don't have Kirk or Scotty around at that point, but the feeling of the show was like, if they made the original series today, that's what it would be like. And this episode feels like that. You know, you could even see this episode. You could take Pike and his crew out. You could put Kirk and Spock and all from the original series in, and you could still do the same story and it would work perfectly fine.
Yeah, the dinosaurs would be a lot more rubber. But, you know,
dinosaurs, they would all walk on two legs.
Exactly.
And they would look like a guy in a suit. And they might slowly try to punch you back if you punch them. But
a bit like a Gorn, honestly. It would like just be like a Gorn. It would be like another Gorn fight. But no, I 100% agree with you.
But before we get away from the Gorn, can I just say one thing?
Oh, yes, please. More Gorn talk.
Well, I watched the opening credits because they show you scenes from all the episode, when maybe not every episode, but, you know, they change those credits up each season and they give you glimpses of places that are going to be visiting in different episodes. And I think, although I only saw it once, so I have to go back, I think I may have seen a Gorn ship. At first I thought, oh, Tholians. But then I thought, no, wait a minute, maybe it's Gorn. So I don't know. I have to go back and watch that again and see.
Gorn, you going to come back, Chris? You know. But
maybe it's Batel coming back. She's on vacation from statue duty.
Yeah. Oh.
And
you get vacation from statue duty? Anyway. Plus, can we talk about, though, too, like the new season beginning and the opening that they always do now for the Star Trek shows, you know, celebrating the 60th anniversary with that wonderful animation of all the ships, you know, and seeing all the ships. I thought that was really nice touch. So again, like, and I was thinking to myself too, as that opening happens, man, this is the 60th anniversary of Star Trek. And so I really hope that this season is good because I want to be able to celebrate 60 years of Star Trek. And that's, I think, the other thing that I'm coming away from this episode with, which is the enjoyment of being like, oh, man, this is the type of stuff that I love about Star Trek. You know, this is this is an episode that reminds you of what you love about this show and many of its iterations. Right. And so, man, you know, that's a great gift, really. To give us as fans, is this being the first episode of season four of Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, for sure. So I had some notes. I was just taking some notes going through the plot. So my first one was about riding horses. And I wrote down, riding horses on the planet Talaxar has nothing to do with the episode, but I love it for the visual and for the connection to Captain Pike. It was just kind of that fun thing where there's something there too that felt like TOS to me. Like, maybe it's because of Pike and the horses, but it just felt like it's just this kind of this strange world and they're riding horses. And I'm thinking, why do the horses look like Earth horses? And can the horses live okay on this planet? But it doesn't matter. Like, they're just dressed as cowboys riding horses around. I thought it was a fun start.
Maybe they're on the North Star planet, just the part we didn't see.
They're on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, the other side of the planet. You know, there's no one village that looks like Avatar.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about the actual premise of the episode. When we saw dinosaurs in the teasers for season four, I never thought they're going to go back to prehistoric Earth. I thought, like, okay, they're going to find some parallel Earth somewhere where there are dinosaurs, or just some other world where dinosaurs happen to also evolve. And no, that doesn't make any sense, but that's just what they're going to do. I never imagined that they would actually go back 65 million years to Earth, and that they would also tell us a story about Mars, and they would rewrite the history of our solar system. And the way that they unravel that in the story, I thought was nice as well in terms of the pacing. Like, we know the Martians are at war with the doldrum, but it isn't until later that we are told that there's a fifth planet and it's between Mars and Jupiter. And so there's this planet that's not in our solar system now, that we never knew about. And because of that, they're able to do even more interesting things with how the events that are happening in this story lead to the evolution of humans and the Federation existing and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't even mention how they get there, which is basically Strange New Worlds Nebula Drift.
By flying through the same storm that's at the beginning of the Magics of Magus 2, the animated series episode.
Oh, yes.
Visually, it looks so similar that I'm pretty sure that
it's on purpose,
when we get extras on the Blu-rays and all the interviews are done and all, I'm pretty sure that that was an intentional recreation of that, because visually it just looks the same. And that's cool if they did that, having a live action version of
absolutely. One of the things too, like you were talking about, is, you know, the beauty of the way they craft the episode, so that there are all these things that can't come online in our knowledge base in the episode because the characters can't have it yet, because so much of the system is having to reboot on the Enterprise and slowly be repowered up because of what they've gone through in this storm and this quantum entanglement that they've gotten caught in. And so that is a great storytelling device to allow the characters, especially Pike, to just be slowly learning where he is, what's going on, what's happening, and have to make really tough decisions without necessarily all the information until the very, very end, when he has 12 seconds basically to make the most important decision in all of humanity. And so I thought, you know, that is a great way to tell a Star Trek episode, because how many times have we seen our captains be in these incredibly dire situations where they just have to make a call based off of their instinct and the information at hand and hope it turns out okay? You know, I mean, every single one of the captains that we've seen, from Kirk to Janeway and onward, they've all had to make these type of decisions. And it just turns out that if Pike doesn't make the right decision here, none of that will ever exist, and neither would, you know, Pike and his crew. Mm-hmm. And so I think,
but it takes him a while to get to that point.
Yes.
You know, not only because of the lack of information, but for me watching it, and I think most viewers probably had this feeling, we see what's going on. There's a civilization on Mars. They're at war with someone else in the solar system. There are dinosaurs on Earth. We're thinking, don't mess with anything. Like, just don't mess with anything. But he wants to help. You know, he's going to try to help the Martians. And you're feeling like, don't do anything. And it's not until the end, like you said, with just seconds left, that he realizes, wait a minute, we have to let this planet be destroyed because it's not there in the future.
Well, and I mean, I think that the crazy part about the episode two is that, you know, the Martians here are doing what they need to do to survive, mm-hmm. right? And in doing what they think is necessary to survive, they end up bringing their own end. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, that is one of the key elements of storytelling for human civilization. You know, will we cause our own extinction
mm-hmm.
because of the choice we make trying to survive, right?
Yeah.
And that's very much the consideration here for the Martians. And like you said, that also quickly, in those 12 seconds, that's the calculus that Pike has to do. You know, and you want that moment where all the things start going in front of his mind as he's mm-hmm. calculating, I can't do anything in this moment, because if I do, I will irreparably change the course of history, because Mars, one, is not supposed to exist the way it exists here, and that fifth planet isn't supposed to exist either. And so, and then the beauty of that is, you know, the moment we get with him and M'Benga at the end, where he's like, trillions upon trillions of lives would not have existed. And, mm-hmm. you know, across planets, the course of time would not have taken the effect that we've seen, because they would, the doldrum would have swept across the galaxy and destroyed many more planets and many more civilizations. And so
mm-hmm.
I think, again, all of this is just one of those things to where Strange New Worlds has always had this interesting aspect of like fate to it, as if there yeah. is something in control of the universe helping things turn out the way it's supposed to. Yeah. And this is another one of those moments where it's like, there is this fated nature to these characters. And, you know, of course, we've been playing with that with Pike the whole time, because we know where he's going to end up, or at least where we think he's going to end up. And so the idea that, you know, we can't escape our fate, and the things that happen to us are should happen and are meant to happen, and they happen for a reason. You know, again, all of that is such a Star Trek discussion, which I just really appreciate about the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the series being built around Pike obviously drives that fate aspect. But like you said, we see it a lot through the series, like on a universe scale. There's the Children of the Comet in season one, where like this comet is almost going to hit this planet, but doesn't. And then they find out later that it's almost like Spock's flight in the shuttle was preordained, or, you know, like it's supposed to happen. And you get that here too, where it's explained, it's very timey-wimey, but it's explained at the end of this episode that, you know, the Enterprise was always there in the past, 65 million years ago, that all of these events had to happen the way that they happened. The Martians had to get the antimatter from the Enterprise and had to destroy the doldrum planet. And then the fragment of that planet crashes into Earth and wipes out the dinosaurs and allows the mammals to rise. And all of that always had to happen, which means that the Enterprise always had to be there. It's sort of like Batille, again, being the statue. Like, she's always been the statue, even though we see her in a period where she's not. And it all doesn't quite make sense. It's hard to wrap your head around it. But the series, like you say, they have this thread running through of fate and how everything, the universe is just unfolds right. as it's supposed to because of this or that.
Well, and I mean, I do think that in that sense, you know, it's interesting that a Star Trek show is kind of dealing with this godlike idea of time, right? That mm-hmm. things would make sense if you were outside of time. And able to direct the course of existence because you're outside of everything, which means you're at every moment of all time. So everything makes sense to you in that way. And again, there's the person running the simulation. Yeah, there's a godlike nature to the aspect of time. And again, the idea of fate, right? That things are fated, that things are meant to happen. And again, that's very, in many ways, that is a very religious idea. That there is something behind everything, helping things work out as they should. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, again, as we're talking about this idea of kind of having our crew become a pivotal point in history, you know, every single one of the characters in all of the Star Trek series ends up being a part of this type of thing, right? You know, Kirk and his crew have that moment. Obviously, Picard and his crew have those moments. Sisko and his crew, Voyager, you know, every one of them kind of has these moments where if they didn't do something at a point in history, then the rest of history doesn't exist, you know, as we know it. And so I got to give it to them. They found a way really to make all this work, even, you know, going back to having dinosaurs on the planet. Now, was it a little like not so great CGI and kind of silly? Yes, but does it work because this show is supposed to be akin to TOS? Right. Yes. So yeah, I'm not going to fault it, you know?
No, I mean, that's why it works. It is like if you did this on The Next Generation or Voyager, we did get dinosaurs on Voyager, but not like these. It would look a little silly, but because of Strange New Worlds being a modern TOS, I think it works quite well. I do kind of wish that at the end of the episode, we get that whole segment where we watch the dinosaurs running around everywhere. I wish we had seen a little bit of that in the middle of the episode instead of the dinosaurs being kind of hidden behind the trees at times, or we just get one here or there. And not had that big thing at the end, because it felt a little bit like they did all this work, but it didn't get cut in to that point in the story, but they didn't want to waste it. So they just tag it all on at the end and let us see everybody running around everywhere. Now, the other way to read it is the dinosaurs were really super happy because they were still okay in that moment. That was before the piece of the doldrum planet crashed into Mexico. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because I was thinking, honestly, okay, we just spent a lot of money here for no good reason. This was not necessary to spend
this
much money.
But we don't want to throw it away, so here it is.
Yeah. So, but, you know, I think The other great part about this episode, again, where it's just so Star Trek, right? We have to deal with the idea of the Prime Directive. And the whole crux of the problem here, which Pike is having to deal with, not having all the information and wanting to do the very human / Starfleet thing, which is help people end a war, right? Not realizing that if he did that, he could possibly be changing the course of the future, and he would have changed the course of the future for his own existence and for the galaxy at large. And so, you know, what I thought was fascinating here is that moment where Pike does nothing is the thing that the Prime Directive requires him to do, which is to not interfere. Right. We see clearly you don't interfere for these reasons because this is the consequence that could happen if you were to mess up in this type of situation, you know?
Yeah. Well, the series started off with him interfering in a situation where they shouldn't have been interfering, right? The very first episode of the season is bringing a pre-warp civilization into the Federation. And we've seen him make decisions like this before, where if some of the crew are in trouble, sometimes he does things that probably aren't the smartest thing to do. Like, you know, Picard probably wouldn't do that kind of thing. make a decision to get involved in something where they shouldn't. But here, yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that we've talked about where the characters, they don't have all the information they need, so they're slowly learning what's going on. That's an important part of the writing, to allow Pike to make these decisions in a way that it doesn't feel so much like he's just turning a blind eye to the rules of Starfleet. Now, when the ship is captured by the tractor beam from the Martian ship, I felt like, and I think Ansem Elgort played this well, you feel like Pike, he realizes that they are overmatched and he's got to do something quickly to figure out how to get to the next step so that they're not just captured or destroyed or anything. So he starts, you know, talking and revealing things. And then he ultimately invites the commander over to the Enterprise. And even his crew is kind of like, is that a good idea? Should we be doing that? But as a viewer, you're also thinking like, I don't know if you should be doing that. But that moment when the tractor beam, talking about TOS again for a minute, when the tractor beam envelops the Enterprise, did you also think of Who Mourns for Adonais with the giant green hand grabbing the Enterprise? Yeah.
Well, and I think like you, like we're talking here, it's one of those things where it's the fate of it being Pike, and everything that he does do actually allows you to get to the place where history plays out the way it should, you know? And so by him inviting them over there, giving them enough access to the computer system, them realizing where, you know, the Enterprise is from, and what their future looks like, and then trying to make sure that that future doesn't happen for them, it's somehow that they will exist still. All of that needs to happen. And so, you know, in that sense, like, fate uses Pike in that way to be able to move the pieces on the chessboard where they need to be, so that ultimately what should happen does happen. And again, I think that's just one of the most interesting parts of the whole thing. And like we mentioned earlier, you know, Cassel in the end is trying to save her planet, and she does for a while, but in the end ends up destroying it through the actions meant to save it. And it's such a, you know, I think of Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer, right? You know, the whole question that Oppenheimer then wrestled with for the rest of his life after creating the atomic bomb, you know, did he create the thing which would allow us to destroy ourselves? Had he become the destroyer of worlds? And in the end, Cassel does become destroyer of worlds. You know, she has become death for her people. She doesn't realize it, but as we learn too, her people do survive. You know, and Benga says, you know, there is Martian DNA because we got a chance to scan it. I found that same DNA strand in a variety of different species throughout the galaxy. And so, as the, you know, you would say in Jurassic Park, life finds a way. And I think that's kind of what the message of this episode is, really, in the end. Life finds a way. And sometimes it's messier and maybe uglier than we would like, but life finds a way.
It makes you wonder if some of that Martian DNA is found in Vulcanoid species, because, you know, these Martians look a little bit Vulcan.
Yes.
They don't look Vulcan, but they look somewhat Vulcan. And of course, we have the Vulcans and the Romulans, but we also know from the Next Generation there are other Vulcanoid species on other planets. So it seems like there's some DNA that was scattered that gave birth to that line of evolution on multiple worlds. I'm not even talking about the chase and the origin of all the humanoid life, but specifically Vulcanoid species. Maybe there is some Martian DNA that was spread out from this point in time 65 million years ago. Just one of the most interesting parts of the story is just the idea that there was this advanced civilization on Mars 65 million years ago. And also the story gives an explanation in the story for why that was possible then, and then why Mars became a dead planet later.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you bringing up the chase does bring up a good question of actually how does this actually fit within canon if it was supposed to be the prime timeline, but it's not, so it doesn't matter. But that does bring up a really good question. But I love the way that that works, right? I love the nature of explaining where does the asteroid belt come from? You know, why does Mars look like it does in the end? And then, you know, what happened to our planet with the extinction there, or the way they explain the extinction of the dinosaurs, right? And so I think all of that, and this is the thing, right? The meticulous attention to detail in this episode is excellent. And if there's anything I think that we, both you and I, were so frustrated with in season three was the lack of attention to detail in so many of the episodes that just left you scratching your head. This is not that type of episode. This is the episode where you're just like watching it and you're never pulled out thinking, well, that, how does that fit with this? And I'm not doing any of that in this episode because it's just a great episode of the series that, again, other than me kind of thinking about the chase because you brought it up, otherwise I never thought of any of that stuff.
Well, the chase still works because the progenitors in the chase, they lived 4.5 billion years ago. So they may have been the ones who seeded life on Mars. So it still works.
That can still work then. There you go.
Yeah. That still works on the timeline. So that's still fine. Now, the one thing that you might wonder about, which isn't explained, is how did the Enterprise get pulled into the Sol system specifically when it got sucked in by the squall, right? That's not explained coincidence, but I actually kind of like that too, because that's a TOS thing, right? That kind of stuff just happens and it's not explained, and it doesn't need to be explained. I think that's one of those things where you just go with it, like, okay, that happened. Now we're here. What are we going to do?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it just works, right? There's nothing that I'm thinking about in that sense where I'm pulled out, and that's great writing.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the characters. Let's just start with one that I mentioned in my little opening, the spunky Vulcan cadet, Asha. Is that how you say her name?
I guess so.
I only watched it once since I only just got access yesterday. So I think that's right. But it's that Vulcan cadet who is, she's got quite an attitude. She's like, she's probably one of the mean girls of Vulcan.
She's a little snot is what she is, Chris, and needs a lesson in manners is what she needs. If there was,
she's definitely one of the rich kids on Vulcan, you can tell.
Oh, right? My gosh. Yes. I will say, if there's any true nitpick I have about this episode, I don't understand why Uhura keeps asking her about her feelings. She's a Vulcan. She doesn't have feelings. So stop asking her about her feelings, because that doesn't make any sense to her as a question. She doesn't care about feelings. So ask her about, what was your experience like? It's not about how do you feel about it. It's what was your experience like? Anyway, you should know this from, you know, having spent, you know, so many seasons with Spock at this point. But
yeah,
I mean, I guess it's fine. Again, I think that if there's anything that was unnecessary in this episode, it was that. Like, you could have pulled that out completely and it was just not needed. And I think you kind of had a question here on the outline. It was like, is this meant to be a recurring character? And that's kind of the feeling I guess I get from her, that in what Uhura says at the end. But it's like, okay, this seems really unnecessary.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I get the feeling that it's not going to be a recurring character because the cadet seems like she wants to leave. And it's, is it explained, again, I only got to watch it one time, is it explained why she's on the ship in the first place? Is she there just for a short-term visit? Is it like a, hey, go see what it's like on an actual starship? Or is she there the way that Uhura came aboard the Enterprise originally, where she's supposed to be there for a while?
It seemed to me that she was there for the same reason Uhura was there. Right?
Okay, well, that would make sense for why Uhura is interacting with her.
As a cadet, you do a rotation, basically, you would in medical school. Yeah. You do a rotation on a starship.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that sense, you feel like, well, maybe this is going to be a recurring character, but I'm not sure, because to be honest, they really don't need to be adding more characters to this show. They've already got enough characters and they only have 10 episodes to work with.
That's true.
Yep. I started thinking about it, and because of some of the stuff that she said about being a Vulcan and Spock maybe benefiting from being half human and such, you know, her path is similar where... Oh, it's somewhat similar. You know, Spock chooses not to go to the Vulcan Science Academy, and then Asha here doesn't get in. She goes to Starfleet as an alternate route, the same way Spock does. So I was wondering if they're trying to mirror Spock's journey a little bit with a pure Vulcan, but I think that's too much to start trying to add into this show at this point. And also, I don't think it's necessary at all for Spock's character. So I don't think they're going to do that. We'll see. But that's it's the only thing I could think of. Otherwise, other than maybe, you know, giving Uhura someone to bounce something off of. But I don't know. It felt a lot like a one-off to me.
Yeah. I mean, history tells me that, yes, this is going to be a recurring character because they felt like they needed to add a whole other story, Ryan, for some reason that was unnecessary. And so
maybe
I would hope that would not be the case. But if I was a betting man, I would say this is probably going to be a recurring character that we have to deal with.
Yeah. So you mentioned medical, and that made me think of something I did want to mention to you, and we can maybe divert here from the characters themselves for a moment and talk about the costume design. Overall, I think some of the updated costume design in this episode looks amazing. The jackets they wear when they go down to the planet, the color combinations and all really look nice. And the medical connection is I really like the subtle change that they did to Nurse Chapel's uniform, where it's not solid white or silver, like the shoulders and all have little very light blue in them now, which mirrors the actual blue medical uniforms. I thought it added a nice depth to that uniform.
Well, and they also gave her the basically like a coat that almost is like, you know, she's wearing the same type of uniform that you would see Number One wear sometimes, where she or Uhura wears, where she's basically wearing the TOS style dress, you know. And so I appreciated that update as well, because it always seemed weird for her to kind of be in this onesie, you know, that nobody else was in. And so this seems to fit the show much better. So I agree. I thought that was a nice touch.
I kind of feel like, I mean, there are two things. Specifically to Strange New Worlds and the costume design, when she first comes to the Enterprise, she's there for kind of like a special reason. She's not there just to be a standard part of the crew. And maybe that's why she has that uniform that feels a bit different from what M'Benga or others are wearing. And the second part that popped into my head right now is I also think that's partially influenced by Discovery's costume design, where the medical staff is wearing this kind of like white onesie type stuff. And that got carried over to hers, maybe. Although that all white onesie with the the hair that they do for Jess Bush as the character does look good together. It's a nice overall look.
Yeah, I liked that. I got to ask you about this, Chris. Some character stuff, just between the characters that they added. So apparently Scotty and Ortegas have a rivalry now that, Scotty has added warning bells to everything, and Ortegas is kind of pissed at all of his notifications that keep popping up on her, dock.
Yeah. So that was funny, and it felt like it came out of nowhere. And obviously, I say obviously, I'm pretty sure this is where they're going with it. They wanted to create some kind of dynamic between these two characters that will run through the season and add another texture to the crew, which I think is fine and is a good idea. It does feel weird, though, when you have two characters who have been interacting with one another for a while, and now suddenly there's this big rivalry going on. And especially at the end of the episode where they bump into each other in the bar and splash the drinks, and you can tell like there's some kind of like really there's this thing going on between them, and how did it get started? But I was thinking, if you're a pilot like Ortegas, and we know she loves flying the ship and she loves going fast, and she's kind of like, you know, she reminds me of like a Top Gun pilot. She's kind of got that attitude to her. And so if you're that kind of pilot, you're going to get annoyed if someone is trying to restrain you in some way. So these little warnings obviously are going to be irritating to her. But if you're the engineer, if you're on Scotty's side, you don't want someone overclocking the engines all the time. You want the engines to be taken care of. You want everything to be working properly. You know the specs. You know that it's not good for the engines to be pushing them in this way. And so, yeah, you're probably going to start building something into the system to warn, don't do that. So I can see it from both of their sides. And I think that the whole thing makes a lot of sense in terms of their roles on the ship. But as you're watching it, you're like, well, that's new. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think actually it just works really well, and it's really fun. And I think a big part of that, right, is that in many ways, Scotty has just become a more integral role to the show. Which
he's become the actual engineer.
Yeah, I don't know what Pellia does on the show anymore other than say stupid things like, you know, the fact that she saw this on Doctor Who. It seems like if you were trying to get rid of any character so that you could really focus, Pellia needs to go because she doesn't really have anything to do on this show anymore other than say ridiculous things. I'm with you. I think, again, the Scotty Ortegas thing is fun because, again, it adds this dynamic that we weren't expecting, but it also makes sense because in some ways, you know, the Scotty that we're seeing here on the show is one that is much more conservative than the one that we'll see later on, right? Where he's much more willing to push the Enterprise to the brink of basically disaster when needed. And part of that will be the relationship he has with Jim Kirk, right? And and I think just growth as a character. And so I think this is really fun. And it again, in many ways, I think Ortegas, of all the characters on the show, is probably the most 21st century human. Like, the most 21st century human of all the characters.
Well, they even had her working on motorcycles last season.
Right, so. Yeah. And Scotty, in some ways, feels the most like the original series character, where he the way he acts with things and the way he treats things and even the way he talks just feels so much more akin to the original TOS. Yeah. And so, but, you know,
but a younger version. Yeah. But a younger version, and absolutely. probably younger than he should be in terms of where the timeline is. Not just the casting of the actor, but the way the character acts. But you could say the same for Kirk as well. And Spock too. Yeah.
I think Spock is definitely too young for this show, in the sense of like how he's portrayed in his casting.
Yeah.
So.
But with Spock, like, there are ways that you could write it where his whole character and demeanor could really drastically change, sure. where he decides to turn away from the human aspects of his personality right now that are really dominating a lot of what he does. Whereas it'd be harder to do that with Scotty or Kirk.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, I do think as a viewer, as long as you don't get all caught up in canon and timelines and does it really make sense, if you just watch it on a little bit more forgiving level, where you're just watching them show us younger,
yeah.
earlier versions of characters and how they evolve and become the people we know, I think it's fine. And I like what they're doing with Scotty, because you can see that, like, all those traits of Scotty that we know are all there in him, but
yeah.
they're not as ingrained and refined and all as what we're used to in TOS, and especially in the TOS films, of course, which
yeah.
have a big time jump in them anyway.
Yeah, I got to ask you, what did you think about that Laan tease? You know, I mean, she's really digging, you know, Spock's chili.
Okay, so I thought you were going to ask about a different tease, and I
no. Oh, is there another tease, Chris? Wink, wink.
Well, there's her teasing Spock, and then there's the writers teasing us about her augment heritage. But yeah, when they first come back up from the horseback riding, yeah, that was a fun scene, because one question we would have going into the season is, are Spock and Laan still an item? Well, they made that very clear right out of the gate that they are not only an item, but they've been doing some work over the last 6 months and in being an item. So that was a great scene. I thought it was really well played. You can see just the look on Spock's face, how excited he is about it. And you can also see on Scotty's face how somewhat uncomfortable he is about it.
All he's thinking is, why am I here? Why am I in this room? Why am I here? Why am I in this room right now? This is so awkward.
Yeah, yeah.
He's basically thinking, get a room, guys. Get a room. And yeah. make it not this one.
But, you know, that pairing of Spock and Laan, it's one of those cases in Star Trek where they bring two characters together, I think largely because of the chemistry between the actors, because Ethan Peck and Christina Chong, I think, have a really great chemistry together. It's like the way that Jadzia and Worf get together on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
kind of driven by actor dynamic.
I mean, if you don't have chemistry with Christina Chong, you're probably dead. Because anyway, what do we think about, though, them teasing Laan? Obviously, I was teasing, but them kind of bringing up this idea that her recessive augmented origin genes are finding a way to the surface, and she yeah. seems to be getting stronger. And is that going to be one of the reasons that we don't see this character maybe even beyond this season?
Yeah.
Because something happens that makes the Enterprise, you know, have to take down one of its own for yeah. the good of, you know,
well,
the galaxy at large.
Yeah. Well, that would be pretty heavy if that's where they go. But they do ask her in this episode, are you going to take over the galaxy now?
Yeah.
And she's not sure.
So, yeah. I like how she's like, I don't think so. Basically, yeah. like, eh, yeah. I don't know. Maybe tomorrow. But, we'll see.
I think it's smart to go into this, though, because otherwise, you remember when they announced the characters for the series before it premiered, and we found out that there is this character, Laan yep. Noonien Singh, right? And you're thinking, okay, well, they've got Uhura on the ship. Now we've got a Noonien Singh. It felt like they're just trying to pull in familiar elements into the show. And people are like, oh, wow, Khan. And now this character has the same name. And they've done a little bit with it. You know, we had the whole Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow where there is some tie-in to what that means, but they haven't really done much with the character. And in fact, they've shied away from it, I think. At the beginning of the series, when they when Chapel injects them so that they transform so they can go down to the planet, you know, that was an opportunity where La'an doesn't want to be, she doesn't want any sedative. And you're thinking, well, it's because she's an augment and she doesn't need it, but that's really not the reason for it. And then they don't really go anywhere with it. So I would like to see them do that this season, have La'an's storyline be her coming to terms with her augment heritage. And I'm not sure what that's going to mean for her, but I think that that allows it to make a lot more sense why you created this character in the first place and you made her a descendant of Khan and the Noonien Singh experimentation and all this stuff. And it'll also allow the relationship with Spock to go somewhere in an interesting way, because we know Spock and her they're not going to be together in the future. This character of La'an, we've never seen this character prior to this series, so we have to assume that she's going to disappear somehow, but not necessarily. You know, I'm not one of those fans who's like, well, we never saw this, and so it can never exist, because obviously if you're writing a TV show over 60 years, you're going to be filling stuff in all the time. So, you know, they could make up some reason why she's okay, but we just don't see her in the future. But I think what you said might be more likely. There could be some tragic ending to her character.
It could. And I would say this to that. I think that would be a mistake for them to go that way, because we already did that with Batel. And I think that feels too much like a retread of storylines. Mm-hmm. I think it would be much interesting. I think it would be much more interesting to find a way to tell a story here with La'an that goes in a different direction, right? And obviously, look, you know, this is one of those things where they keep saying this is canon and everything. And so in the end, you have to do something with her if you're playing that game. And so, but there are plenty of places La'an could go that don't require her, you know, to have to die. Because, you know, we know Spock doesn't have her as a love interest later on.
Yeah.
And well, so, maybe. In fact, Spock doesn't have any love interests that we see, you know, down the road. And so, I mean, that's another thing. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe La'an becomes the Federation ambassador to the Gorn homeworld. That's going to be her ultimate fate.
Yeah, maybe. There, it could possibly be. So, yeah.
I mean, she's had experience with them. She's good at punching reptiles.
It's true. And she's really good at punching reptiles. Yeah. So, yeah, we've seen that.
It could be that.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But, yeah, I mean, of course, everything is canon. I mean, anything made by the IP holder that's put on screen is canon. The question is, what timeline?
Well, you know what I mean. It's like, is it in the prime timeline question?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I bring it up because there are fans who want to say anything that they don't like is not canon. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing, but, you know,
there'll
be people who say Discovery's not canon. Well, it is canon, but all the pieces may not fit together,
sure,
you know, the way that you expect. And that raises, I mean, the thinking about the fact that they go back 65 million years in this episode and they allow events to unfold as they apparently did 65 million years ago that we never knew about, so that the future is not altered. But there's basically like a loop going on, right? And it's the same thing if you think about, you know, first contact with the Borg. The Enterprise had to always go back in time to stop the Borg. You know, you get into these time loops. But then you've got the fan theories that because of First Contact and what the Enterprise did there, that the TV series Enterprise with the NX-01 is set in an alternate timeline. So you get all timey-wimey with all these time travel stories, but I love them nevertheless. I always love these time travel stories. And in this one, we were talking about this, I think, as far as a story unfolding for an entire episode, in all the time travel stories we've had in Star Trek, I think this is the farthest back in time that they've gone. The only other two things I can think of that are further back in time are All Good Things, where Q shows Picard primordial Earth before there were even any dinosaurs or anything. It's all the way back to when the Earth was forming. And in Death Wish on Voyager, Quinn transports Voyager to just before the Big Bang, momentarily. Yeah. But those are both just like moments in a story. So we've jumped all over the place in Star Trek, but I believe this is the farthest back where we've gone and actually told a full story that has consequences for the future.
Yeah, I think you're right. One last thing that I wanted to bring up, Chris, was just we talked a little bit about you know, the beginning and the riding the horses on the planet, and one of the things that I think Star Trek Strange New Worlds has freed itself from reality because it's able to do basically whatever it wants on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And in that,
because of the technology,
right,
you mean
exactly
like having the wall behind. Yeah.
And I feel in some ways as if there's something that's kind of been lost from the series.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in that scene, it's fun that they're riding horses and all this stuff, right? It's cute. But it never feels real. It always feels fake. And there's something about, you know, the way Star Trek was done, you know, from the 60s, obviously, all the way through the Berman era, where there was a grounded nature to the show because of what they could pull off. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even if you were on a set, there was still a reality, you know, mm-hmm. to where you were, or matte painting or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I feel as though that Star Trek has lost a little bit of its groundedness, which is one of the important aspects of it, right? You know, Roddenberry's vision of the show was that it was this thing that was an extrapolation of our future as it could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
So it was meant to feel more grounded in that sense, right? Yes, the technology felt fantastical in those ways, but the things and the planets we visited and all that was supposed to have this feeling of a grounded nature. And I wonder if you feel that at all sometimes when, you know, we see these planets and these backdrops and it's like they feel the mm-hmm. need to basically, as Scotty says in Star Trek V, overwork the plumbing. So it's just so easy to stop up the drain. And what I mean by that is it becomes easy to stop up my imagination from being able to disconnect because it's like I'm never in the scene because I know that there's no way this could ever exist anywhere. Physics doesn't work like this, you know. I'm not on Pandora, you know. So this just feels like I'm trying to be outlandish for outlandish sake, and I wonder if that we're losing maybe something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think it's largely, well, it's driven by the wall and having that technology to be able to just do anything, like you said. And that has become so common on science fiction television and films as well, but especially TV, because you could always do stuff like this in films if you had enough money. If you wanted to spend the money, you could do more expensive things, but you couldn't do it on TV, and now you can. And I think that whether it's true that there's a fan expectation for that type of scenery in science fiction shows today, like Star Trek or Star Wars shows or whatever, I don't know if that's true that fans expect it, but I do think that creators think that fans expect it. And so that's one reason that they do it. I also think as a designer myself, as a creator, I can completely understand the urge to do it, the drive to do it. I think part of design, part of filmmaking, television is learning how to have restraint and to know when to not do something, even though you could do it. And I think sometimes that's missing. Like because they can do it, they really go overboard with it. Look how cool this looks. You see that in video games too, or video game developers will do things that are maybe just a little bit too much and they harm the gameplay just because they have the graphics power to do it.
Yeah.
But I will say that some things that seem outlandish on Strange New Worlds, I do appreciate a lot of what is going on behind the scenes. I don't know if you've watched the extras on the season 3 Blu-rays, but they show extensively how they did those opening scenes of the season where La'an and everyone are in the Gorn, like a hatchery, like where they're like stuck in those, I don't know what they're even called, but like the Gorn are like digesting them basically.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of hands-on physical design and makeup. I mean, the makeup is extensive what they did to Ortegas and La'an, and stuff that when you see it on the screen, you might think it's CGI, but it's not. It's like really all practical effects.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've seen that in some of the Star Wars stuff as well, a return to practical effects and and real sets. And so even though they have this wall behind them in Strange New Worlds, they are doing a lot of stuff and very complex stuff that's real in front of it.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate the work that they're doing on that. Yeah. I think things like riding the horses, where it's just a vast planet, is a bit much. One of the most egregious cases that I have seen is in the beginning of season 5 of Discovery, and some of the scenes of like Michael and Book on basically motorcycles, like vehicles on this planet, and like the storm that's going and all.
That'll do it.
It's just too much. Like, it's just too unrealistic. I would rather see something that you might see, you know, like an Indiana Jones movie from the 80s or something, where it's much more practical and realistic, and it doesn't have to be so over the top visually.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on Valis Marineris, and what's your rating for this one?
Yeah, look, I think this really truly is a great episode of the series. I think it's a great episode of Star Trek in general. I think it's a return to what we all kind of hoped this series was going to be in the first place, which is, I'm so thankful for it. Like, it is hard for me as a fan of Star Trek to explain just how thankful I am for an episode that truly seems to grasp what modern Star Trek can be when you're not trying too hard. You're actually just trying to tell a good story and not be outlandish for outlandish sake. This is crazy and outlandish by throwing you back 65 million years, but it's doing it in a way that encompasses everything that makes Star Trek great, which by giving your captain a moral conundrum he has to work through, you know, and putting your crew in a place that you just didn't expect even to be possible, and placing you in a place that you shouldn't be, and somehow finding your way back and it all turning out okay. That's, you know, and at the same time, having fun little character moments here and there, you know? And so I'm hard pressed, because of the experience that we've had with season 3, not to just give this a 5 out of the gate. A 5 out of 5. 5 out of 5 massive asteroids heading for Earth, because it's a return to all that we were loving about season 1 and some of season 2. So I'm just going to do it, Chris. I'm giving this 5 out of 5 because I just, I you know, I know it's already made and it doesn't really matter, but I just hope and pray the rest of the season can kind of have this look and feel to it, because goodness, I had a blast watching it and rewatching it. So how about you, Chris?
Yeah, no, I agree with you on pretty much all those points. I wanted to mention one thing. When we talked about Pellia, I you mentioned that she just says a lot of crazy stuff, but I wanted to say that one of the good things about that, I guess, is that often you can't understand what she's saying, so you don't know how crazy it is. This accent that Carol Kane created for Pellia just gets more outrageous all the time, to the point where, and I'm being honest, I can't understand what she's saying some of the time. Like, I really don't know what she's saying. And I don't have the benefits of the subtitles usually when I'm watching, because at this episode, I didn't turn them on. But normally I watch I have Japanese subtitles on bottom, so I'm not like following what she's saying exactly. So anyway, I noticed that towards the end, there's a moment where she's on the bridge and they're trying to figure out whether they're going to stop the Martians or not. And she kind of slips out of that accent into something that's a little bit more reasonable. And I wish the directors, if they're going to keep her on the show, I wish the directors would sometimes ask her to dial it back a little bit, because she's just becoming like a ridiculous comic relief and nothing else, and doesn't really contribute much to anything that's going on, which is too bad. I mean, there are episodes over the last couple seasons that she's quite good in and important for the story. Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow being one of them. But right now, yeah, not thrilled with that. But outside of that, I love that they decided to give us an in-universe explanation for why the Valles Marineris exists in the first place on Mars. If you don't know what it is, it's that like gigantic scar that's going across Mars, which is like a series of canyons. It's 4,000 kilometers long. And in the real world, scientists believe generally that it's rift faults primarily that created this. But I love that in the Star Trek universe, it's actually that space spiders crashed on Mars and started eating the planet. And the only way the Martians could get rid of them was to destroy all the land around it. And that's why there's this gigantic scar on the planet.
Yeah, so I agree.
That's kind of a fun little thing to throw in there. And it's just one of so many fun and interesting and smart and creative things that the writers did with this story. And yeah, I think this is going to go down as one of the favorites among all the Star Trek series for fans, just because it works great as a self-contained story. It does a lot for the series itself and the characters. It's so well produced. So yeah, I'm going to give it, yeah, I think I'll also go ahead and give it a perfect score, which I rarely do, but I'm going to give it 10 hordes of space arachnids.
Ooh. That just gave me the shivers.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Valles Marineris. It does sound kind of like a sauce, but it's not. There are many ways for you to share those with us, perhaps. Going to Facebook is the best way. You can go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. You will find a post on the timeline there for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. And again, that is the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L. You can also send us email if you like. Go to our website, tfm.fan. That's tfm.fan. That is our new website. Go to tfm.fan/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose Saddle Up, and that'll write its way right over to Matthew and me with its chaps and all on by email. And you can also find us on social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying your best to figure out what on earth Pellia is saying, where can people find you?
You can find me all over social media under the name Matt Rushing 02, of course, here on the network, outside all the great Star Trek talk we do, Chris. People can find me in the 602 Club, talking about all of the franchises we love outside of Star Trek. Over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me with two shows, one called Owl Post, talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, And then I'm on aggressive negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, when you're not trying to figure out, you know, why Lalan keeps calling you to her quarters to help with their boots, where can people find you?
Yeah, I cannot share those reasons with you, at least not on air here. We want to...
Man, I guess Shania Twain said it all. Whose bed have your boots been under?
That's right. You know, it would be so funny if the title of the next episode was "Whose Bed Have Your Boots Been Under?"
There you go. And Spock just had a guilty look on his face the whole time.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Let's move on. You can find me elsewhere on the network, doing all those shows with you, of course. And you can find me in the back catalog from the last 16 plus years across many shows, talking about every corner of the Star Trek universe, pretty much. You can also find Larry Nemechek and me on the Ready Room from time to time. And you can also find me in social media. My username everywhere is C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active, but that's my username everywhere. So you can drop me a line wherever you are. And if you would like to help us keep Saddle Up and all of our rewatches and all the other stuff that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to support the network, how to get involved, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We would not be here without your support. So thank you so much to everyone who is supporting us now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time where, I don't know, are we going to be talking about some kind of lion-eagle hybrid, or I don't know what it's going to be about as the Griffin incident is headed our way.
Well, Chris, you know, I've always wanted to meet a Gryffindor, so hit it.